Welcome to the Spike Feed, your number one source of Magic the Gathering tournament information and financial coverage. I am one of your hosts. My name is Curtis. Alongside me, my partner in crime, Dustin. Dustin, how are you, sir?
Doing all right. Still waking up from the day.
And we have our producer on the line as well. He's our resident MTG noob, Cameron. Cameron, how are you?
Good, man. How are you?
I am fantastic. I'm excited to get started. This is our inaugural show, right?
Episode 101?
Yeah. I'm pumped. Yeah.
Does that mean we get a party?
No. Maybe after, like, what do you think, 50 episodes?
We get a party then?
Yeah.
Something like that? Anyway, so let's kind of run down the show. We're going to talk about our week, what we've been playing. We're going to talk from the vaults, do a little deck tech with green-red aggro. We're also going to talk about those black-on-black planeswalkers, and then we're going to assist Cameron in the ever-evolving journey of becoming a tournament Magic player. So let's start with what we've been playing. Cameron, I know you've been crushed at work, so you didn't get to go out to FNM. But Dustin, you've been playing a brew at FNM and
Correct.
Just crushing with it. So why don't you talk about that real quick?
Well, I had called you a while back and talked about some green-black action that I was thinking about. And what we decided to do on there was Lotleth Trolls, Grave Crawlers, Scavenging Ooze, Deathrite Shaman, and like 20 removal pieces. Right?
Right.
And with so much creatures just coming about in standard right now, I mean, the aggro is unreal, so all this removal just, it's gravy, man. And then, you know, Scavenging Ooze is getting bigger, Deathrite Shaman's getting, you know, value out of the removal because they're losing two life every time you remove one of them. It's just synergy left and right.
And I have to ask, so this, it's basically a Golgari graveyard synergy deck most of the time, right?
Right.
But your metagame, I guess our local metagame, is very aggro-centric. There's not a lot of control players.
Correct.
And you're probably playing against a lot of Naya and Jund and these kinds of things where you are like able to outvalue them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to ask, like, what do you find is your most difficult matchup? Because I know, what, you finished in the top four for these kind of big FNMs several weeks in a row.
Right.
Have you had any, like, difficulties? What's the one matchup that you're, like, dreading with this brew?
The only thing that I run into that's a little rough is when people have a lot of gold cards. If you're running something like Huntmaster and Olivia, the reason for that is I run Ultimate Price in the main instead of Doomblade. So mm-hmm. that means I can't hit either of those in game one. And then if you side in Doomblade, you're still kind of weary on Olivia or even Falconwrath Aristocrat. So you have to wait till you get the Putrefy because they're out of range of Abrupt Decay. So that's like the one creature that just kind of worries me because I don't have any good flying to block it or anything.
Well, I think Olivia shuts down a ton of creature decks, right? Like, she's just a problem for a ton of different, you know, matchups. But, dude, I think it's great. And we're going to talk about this a little bit in the next segment. But I just think Standard's in such a cool place where you're able to just slap together this brew and be so effective with it, you know?
I agree. I love an environment where you can build something without being scared of all the net decks. And Standard's just so wide open right now that, I mean, you're seeing like 10 or 12 different decks at an FNM, and it's great.
Yeah. Can I piggyback on that with my week just real quick?
Do it, man.
So I played game day. This would have been a week ago. I didn't play this current weekend. And I showed up with a blue-white-red brew, an Aetherling deck, basically. And I played against a guy that was playing Simic Splashing White for Geist of St. Traft. Like, played Rapid Hybridization, played Cloudfin Raptor, Young Wolf.
Did it work?
It was wild. And he beat me like a drum in the Swiss rounds. Like, I had no idea what was going on.
A Cloudfin Raptor?
A Cloudfin Raptor.
That's so weird.
I like that card. I was hoping it would start seeing some play.
Hey, man, he made it happen. I mean, he had, you know, some of these draws that was like Geist of St. Traft, Rancor, and initially I had him on Bant Hexproof because that's a typical opening for that deck.
Right.
But then whenever I go to blast something and he Rapid Hybrid, I don't even know what the verb is for that. Hybridizes,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of a blowout. I met him later on in the top four and was able to take him largely because I was a little bit more familiar with the tricks of the deck. But I have to, you know, this is our first show, but I have to come clean on something, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned this before. We've all talked about it. War Leader's Helix.
Oh God.
I'm total 180. I'm a believer. That card.
I am amazing. Still not a believer.
It's a good Magic card. I never thought I'd say those words out loud. 4 mana for 4 damage seems crazy, but I had so many blowouts. Just so many ridiculous blowouts with that card.
Is it 4 damage?
Yeah, it's 4 damage. You gain 4 life. And it's instant speed, which matters. And nobody plays around it, at least in
that situation. The instant speed does matter. I understand that. Once rotation happens, what 4 toughness creature are you worried about? Or is this just gone?
I don't know if 3-color decks are going to be a thing.
Right.
We're going to see, because right now there's not really support for that.
Right. Unless you Guildgate.
Right, right. And War Leader's Helix, I don't think, is going to be good in a Boros-type strategy, where it's very aggressive red creatures. I just don't think that's going to be good enough. I think it has to be a control shell, and you're going to have to play 3 colors. Obviously, it pairs very well with Sphinx's Revelation, but everything pairs well with Sphinx's Revelation.
Right.
Anyway, Cameron, you didn't get a chance to play at all, right? So you're just totally in the dark.
So I was at this thrift store place at the fairgrounds, and there was a guy selling Magic cards with his own art on them.
Altars,
Fair?
Yeah. So yeah,
at
it
the
was
Iowa
so
State
cool.
Fair.
So
the
like
guy
there's
I
just like
fair. Okay.
Iowa State Fair. There's just a big craft area, right? That just has people selling various types of art. Well, this guy had Magic cards, and so he had these really cool wolf tokens with a Wile E. Coyote on them.
That's hilarious.
And, just cool things like that. It was so that's my bit of magic that I had this week that I got a kick out of those.
Cameron, come clean. Did you buy a wolf token?
I really wish I had. I didn't have any cash on me, otherwise I would have.
Did he have only magic stuff in this craft spot, or did he have other stuff as well?
No, he did altars to Pokemon cards and some other,
but it was still
TCG various stuff. Things. Yeah, yeah.
That's just really odd to me that it's at a state fair. But hey, I mean, more power to the guy. If the guy can make money, take every outlet you got, right?
The Iowa State Fair is odd in a number of ways, and I mean, you'll just find pretty much anything. There.
Well, you were at a jam contest, weren't you? And we're not talking about jam as in a band. We're talking jam as in preserves.
And dude, jellies. Okay, complete difference to jams.
This is off the topic, but
that kind of stuff makes sense at a fair, though.
Yeah.
Let's just be real here. Jam is always better than jelly.
Absolutely.
I don't know about
that.
That
is. It's
I don't know
strictly
about that.
Better.
Sorry.
Strictly.
I'm a grape jelly guy.
Okay.
That's the way it goes.
Let's move on and talk about kind of the news from this previous week. We're going to cover about a week and a half because there's a ton of stuff to talk about. I want to tie this in with our conversation about Standard because there was a lot of kind of, I'd say, prominent pros that were disappointed in the way Standard played at the Magic World Championship. They thought the deck lists were boring and uninteresting and that Magic has gotten increasingly less skill intensive. And obviously, Dustin, you and I have been pretty big fans of this current Standard format.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wanted to sound off about this a little bit and talk about the skill intensive versus not skill intensive stuff. How do you feel about it? You said you're enjoying Standard because you get to brew. Is there anything else that really stands out about the format to you?
Well, when they say it's not very skill intensive, I'd say it all depends on the deck that you're playing. There's still a lot of choices to be made with some of these decks. Not everything is autopilot, so I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, if you're unhappy with where you're playing or what you're playing, then change it up, get a different deck, try something new. I don't know. It seems like
it's
an
not
easy
like
answer
you're
to
going to Target and buying those 2 30-pack starter packs where person one has this, person two has that, and it's as basic as possible. You know,
right?
Well, I mean,
and the thing
interesting
is. Right before rotation, you have more cards to experiment with than when something rotates out, right? Because you lose 3, technically 4 sets with a core set, right? So it's kind of 3.5 sets because of the reprints. But yeah, it's you have so many options right now. Try something new.
I guess for me, the thing is, yeah, I think Standard's fairly straightforward, but I think it should be. I think it's really good for the health of the game that the most popular format is extremely accessible. We're living in a world where Magic is competing against a lot of different games, both physical and digital, right?
Right.
And
board
if you want a complex
taking, yeah.
game, go join a cube draft or play Legacy, right? Those things exist for you.
This is coming from the same people that were complaining when they lowered the amount of buys that you could get, right?
Dude, I mean,
so they want free wins, and then they want games to where, you know, they're better than everybody else always. What's wrong with some healthy competition, right?
There has to be some level of luck. Otherwise, we're playing chess.
Right.
Right? Like, you need some kind of thing where the lesser player wins on occasion. Otherwise, it's not that good of a game, just being straight up with you. But second of all, I think there are other outlets for that kind of play. And if we really are honest that Magic needs to grow, and it does, then you have to have something that's a little bit more accessible at the base level, right? You know, I'll just throw League of Legends out here. You know, that's accessible and the tutorial, but I think the unfortunate drop off for games like that is that they're not friendly to new players. Right. Magic needs to strive for that. So if you just come down from your high horse, and by the way, Standard isn't for dummies either. Like you were saying, some of these decks are not easy. Some are, right?
Right.
But like some of the Sphinx's Revelation decks are really tough to play correctly.
Yeah, it's all about timing.
Yeah, it's really all about timing. And, you know, I've suited up this blue-black control deck that LSV was playing on his stream, and it's really tough, like most blue-black decks tend to be. But, yeah, so there's that. Let's keep on this complain train, okay? And let's talk about From the Vault 20. Now, Dustin, you're the guy. You've got some of these coming your way. You're our finance guy. You're pretty excited to click on that link, and then you saw the spoiler.
Right.
So you can't be totally unhappy because you're getting Jaceous, right? Like, so no, financially, it's fine.
Right, financially.
Well, what was your overall assessment of the set?
Okay, so like you said, financially, From the Vault 20 it's perfect. You know, whatever. You are making so much bank if you can find these things at MSRP. Now, if you're looking as a player and you're trying to get a few of these, then yeah, you're still kind of shafted, right? But it happens. What I'm looking at here, though, is the majority of things, they don't seem 20th anniversary or, you know, the card out of the tournament deck per year or something, you know? It almost seems like they picked some really good stuff and then just filled out some extra stuff for EDH players or something. I don't know.
So, I'm kind of right there with you. So, in the article that I sent you guys in the show notes, there is a reasoning behind why every card is chosen. Right. Mm-hmm. And I understand that they have a lot of masters to serve. They have to fulfill cube players and EDH players and all that stuff. Some of this stuff is on the reserve list. I get that. But some of the reprint choices, if you're honestly telling me these are the 20th anniversary Magic the Gathering cards, I think it falls way short of these kind of defining moments in the game. Okay, like when I first opened the link, I was super happy. Dark mm-hmm. Ritual and Swords to Plowshares are cards that are super important to the history of the game. They really
right.
are.
Right.
And then, like, the stuff from the last 2 or 3 years, like, where it starts with Chameleon Colossus?
Right.
What? Well, how is that a card that you're going to choose to represent the, like, 20 years of Magic history, right? They don't mention Fairies, which was the dominant deck for a year.
Right.
Right? Cobblade gets Jace, which, okay, whatever.
Okay, so
nothing from Jund.
Curtis, you and I have been playing this game a long time. You know, I started back in Revised. You were right within a couple of months at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard of Chameleon Colossus, right? isn't that a bad thing when you've been playing, like, close to the whole 20 years and they put a card in here you've never even heard of?
I mean, the card was in a tournament-winning deck. I get that. But, like, the last few, like, Kessig Wolf Run and Green Sun Zenith, like, those are the last 2 years, I believe, listed on the From the Vault.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way you can say that those are the defining cards of the past 2 years. They're good cards. They're in good decks.
Well, okay, so it's not necessarily the defining card of the year. It would be something that was, you know,
in the defining deck.
Right, winning tournaments constantly,
well,
right?
Well, the only thing that fills that role in the last 5 years is Cruel Ultimatum.
Okay.
I mean, Green Sun Zenith, while a good card, is not the card from that deck, right? And they don't even mention Cobblade. They actually cite Jace the Mind Sculptor in a blue-black control deck,
right?
So, like, well, there's just...
I have to differ with you on Green Sun, because Green Sun was used in so many decks, you know?
Yes, it was used. I'm not saying it's not used, but it's not... I mean, dude, the defining deck of that era was Delver. It was.
Fair enough.
And, like, there's nothing from that. They don't even acknowledge it. But fairies, I mean, we could go back and forth, but nothing from fairies and nothing from Jund is crazy town. Like, right. Whatever. And, sorry, some of the older choices are a little bit bizarre, too. Like, the card from Blue Black Psychotog is Chainer's Edict, not Psychotog. Like, you're not going to get the card that's the name of the deck.
So, I have to ask, why do we have Char instead of just, like, Lightning Bolt, right?
They point to a specific tournament. I believe there's a link to the video, and that's why they chose that one.
Okay.
But I don't know. Like, there are so many cards I would have chosen differently. Some of them I can get on board with. Like, Venser, I'm fine with. Like, I think that is a very indicative card of that era.
Well, so if they point to a certain one for Char, the big match that we had, it was Finkel and who was it?
Kibler.
Kibler, right? And he, like, double Galvanic Blast him, right?
Triple, yeah.
What triple, right? Shouldn't the card be, like, Galvanic Blast?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted it from the perspective of the history of the game.
Right.
And I don't think that they meant that. You know, the card from Astral Slide is not Astral Slide.
Right.
Right? The card from the very infamous combo deck, is Impulse, not, you know, Cadaverous Bloom, which was kind of the namesake card of the deck.
Right.
That kind of stuff just irritated me. And it just kind of all wraps up in this thing of, I don't think they're doing a very good job with their 20th anniversary. Nobody thought Magic would last this long. And I don't feel like they're actually celebrating it in a meaningful way. Right? We're getting this box set that I don't really care for that's super hard to find.
Right.
Good job, guys. Wow. Awesome. 20 years.
Are they trying to kill themselves?
You would think they would have, like, something, I don't know, something like, if you play F&M, there's an additional promo or something. And they can have, like, a 20th anniversary singular promo for the entire year, right? Not like they change it every month, and the top winner at an F&M gets it. Give it to one person per F&M. And then something like that, right? You get that plus the F&M promo. You know? I mean, celebrate it somehow.
But there's just nothing like that, and I find it really disappointing. So, sorry to go kind of on my tangent there, gentlemen.
It's all good, man.
It's all right, yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, so let's go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll be back with our deck tech. We are talking Deck of the Week, and how it would be remiss if we didn't mention that Gen Con's happening right now, and there's not really a huge tournament outside of that, but the tournament the week before was dominated by this green-red aggro deck, and Cameron, you saw this, and you were like, this is the kind of deck I want to play, right?
Yeah.
What
it's
appeals
just,
to you about it?
Very straightforward. I mean, just... As the guy who's really just starting and really trying to figure out how to build decks, I don't know. There's very specific creatures. I like the Scavenging Ooze in there. The Domri Raid is one that I'm not familiar with, and I was hoping that you guys would explain it to me as far as which one of the... Is it the negative two with the target creature you control fights another target creature? Is that really like the...
That does become relevant at some point. Depending on board state, I would say the bigger one is this plus one.
Okay.
Because you can peek and see if there's a creature, and if so, you're getting card advantage to where you can basically play two creatures a turn mid-game instead of one.
Nice. Okay.
So, yeah, here's what I'll tell you, Cameron. What Domri does is he provides a significant long-term advantage.
Right.
On turn three, he's there, but he's not necessarily
doing
anything.
That's the big thing, too. He is a three-drop planeswalker. In this deck, you can have him out turn two.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And in a creature mirror, he provides a ton of advantage. In the control matchup, which control decks would typically just drum a deck like this, right? Because you're not getting out fast enough, and you know they're going to wrath you before you're able to post lethal damage. Domri's kind of a nightmare for a control deck. Because what'll happen is I don't have a meaningful way. I say me, like, because I normally play control decks. I don't have a meaningful way of removing Domri. And so eventually he will hit his ultimate. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it's basically impossible for a control deck to win.
Wouldn't control decks right now have Disperse?
No, they don't play Disperse. They don't play Disperse.
Well, I'm saying it's available.
I mean, the number one way to get rid of it would be Detention Sphere.
Right.
Which is still kind of awkward. But yeah, Domri is a very powerful long-term plan. Kind of one of the really strong cards in this deck is Thundermaw Hellkite. Like, he's the guy that when you're in a creature mirror and things are stalled, closes. I mean, he closes the deal fast.
Well, you say that, but I would say Hellrider is almost equally as good as Thundermaw, especially when you got all these little elves and everybody out.
Right. I think Hellrider is better when you're trying to, when there's not a stall, right? Whenever you're just ahead and trying to stay ahead.
Right.
But yeah, if you turn three a Hellrider, that's kind of a nightmare for your opponent as well.
Right.
Provided they don't have a Doomblade. If they have a Doomblade, then who cares?
Right.
But that's just how these kind of things work. But I just think this deck is just like, it's green-red classic, you know? Like, you get it as soon as you look at it, and it's extremely powerful. This is not the kind of deck I want to play because the mirror feels like kind of a coin flip.
Right.
But it's good.
I would have to say I'm quite surprised that there's no Bonfire in the side.
I've seen it in some. Of course, I think Chandra Pyromaster is not that great, but she's in it.
I've seen it in a lot of sideboards, but no one's using it. It's like always stays in the sideboard.
Because it's not that good.
I just don't get it.
Dude, the good card in the sideboard is Burning Earth.
Until rotation.
That card, yeah, against Jund and against, you know, Control, they have a hard time beating. So, like, you know, Cameron, let me just paint this scenario. Let's say I'm Control, you're playing this deck, you get me down to 12, and then I Wrath you. Then you stick this card.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lost. I can't play any cards.
That is a sweet card.
So, yeah, there's actually, it's also the first card to come along in a while to try and tell you, hey, maybe you should play two colors.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's been playing really greedy three-color decks.
Some four.
Yeah, some four. And so, yeah, I think this deck is a nice little response to that. I mean, Dustin, what's the spec on Burning Earth? Did that go up any? Or?
Burning Earth has been sitting around about $5 Star City price.
That's pretty nice for mana barbs.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but I have a feeling that once rotation hits, this thing is going to be like $1, $1.50.
We will see. We will see. You know, dude, what card I love in the side is Flames of the Firebrand. Yeah. Get him, Chandra.
I don't know, man. I'm thinking that Volcanic Strength. I mean, it's plain and simple, you know?
Dude, the instant I'm playing an enchantment in my sideboard, or I'm sorry, an aura, count me out. That is just not my style at all. That's a nightmare. Because, you know, if you're wondering, whenever I play, if I go to do that, if they have the Doomblade, they always have the Doomblade.
Right.
That always happens to me. Right? You got to minimize these kinds of things. Anyway, Dustin, let's talk a little bit about finance while we're on the topic.
All right.
Black on black planeswalkers. So Cameron, do you know what these things are?
They look sweet, is what they are. I mean, I don't know.
Okay, what would you pay?
They just look awesome.
For a black on black planeswalker.
For black on black, I don't know. Maybe 50% of what the asking price of one of the regular planeswalkers are.
You would pay less?
No, I'm sorry. Whoa. No. How about, I don't know.
150%
more?
There you go. Yeah,
there
maybe
you go.
Like a little bit over, I don't know. Yeah, twice as much maybe.
So, all right, Dustin, what's this box set actually go for if there's five?
Cameron, for your first statement, they look much better in person than they do in pictures.
They are amazing. They look cool in pictures.
Right. In person, it's even better. And a lot of times in the pictures, you can't see the foiling process that's on them. They are foil.
They are.
Yes. Okay, so moving on. You can get eBay price, on average, a complete set for close to $400.
So that's five cards.
That's five cards. Now, when broken up singly, Garruk, Caller of Beast, is the most expensive one. His eBay price lingers around about maybe $120. Star City's selling him at $150s. Mm-hmm. The rest of them, Johnny's definitely the cheapest. Some of them, like Johnny and sometimes Liliana, can get around 90s. And then Jace is like 112s, 120s. And then Chandra. Chandra's kind of weird because sometimes she's like 90, but sometimes she's like 110, 115. So it just depends
on
the
day. Just to clarify, they are different artwork than the normal one too, right? Like it's alternative art.
It's alternate art. All five are done by Steve Prescott.
It looks like something from like a Frank Miller, you know, circa 1994. Like, it's so good.
Right,
I love
it.
So the question is, Dustin, let's say Joe Trader comes up to me.
Right.
And says, hey, I got a black on black planeswalker. I got a Garruk, and I'm willing to trade you at 120 should I put together $120 worth of cards to try and acquire this? Is it something that'll go up or go down? What do you think?
My answer is yes, definitely. And the reasoning here is it's going to be very rare for you to find these in trade books. I almost guarantee that. It's like if you see someone that's willing to trade it off, grab it. And especially if he's doing 120, you would think that they want more. The very few people I have seen with these in trade books want more than Star City price. The speculation on them is astronomical. A lot of people compare these to the full art Mutavaults and say basically once they disappear, sky's the limit, right? And in that sense, it's not one card, it's five cards.
Okay. So what are you trading them at?
When I can get them, I'll go Star City price. Very rarely can I justify giving somebody more than Star City price. When you're speculating on something going up, you don't typically overpay for it, right? I mean, you typically, like, Thalia, I think, will go up in a couple years. So getting them at $3 right now and just in abundance seems fine to me. But it's not like I'm saying, oh, this card's going to be worth $15 5 years down the road, so I'll just go ahead and trade into them at sevens when they're threes, right? It'd be ridiculous. So unless you have a person that is asking for a lot of junk that you don't care about, you know, when they're probably asking for legacy cards, stick with Star City pricing. I mean, yes, they're very pretty. They're very nice to have, but there is a limit to how much you should pay.
Okay. So I'm just painting a scenario here again. Just let's pretend I have a crispy mint revised Underground Sea.
Right.
And this person comes up to me with a Garruk and a Liliana, roughly the same value.
So it's within about $10.
Should I do that or not?
So that's within about $10 of Star City pricing because Liliana has gone down a little bit. That is a tough call. That would also depend on playability, too, because if you're a legacy player, you're probably going to want to keep the Underground Sea unless it's extra, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That being said, I could see the Garruk growing in price exponentially compared to the Underground Sea in the short term. Whereas long term, Underground Sea, you know, sky's the limit on that too, right?
Right.
But yeah.
So it's pretty much like a Jackson Pollock painting is what you're saying, and just set it on your shelf and it'll collect value.
Exactly. I'm thinking that in 2 years' time, these planeswalkers will be so hard to find that a Garruk that's 150 now, there's no reason it won't be $300. The basis with this, too, is if we look at the Jace Bellerin book promo, Jace Bellerin regular is like $6, $7. This book promo is now reaching up towards 150 sometimes. And that thing's been out, what, 2-3 years? Maybe less?
I think it's three.
Okay.
It's right at three.
Right. And when it first came out, people were kind of crazy about it. It was like 50, then 60, and it's just been growing and growing. I understand Jace has played in a lot of formats and, you know, people like to show them off. I still think these look better, but they might not be as utilitarian as Jace Bellerin.
Yeah, Jace Bellerin also sees a little bit more like cube play than some of these.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, Cameron, what you're going to find when we go through these financial segments, it's the world of Magic economics is a fascinating unregulated marketplace with all the, you know, kind of highs and lows that go with it. But Dustin, while he is certainly a speculator and a trader and a binder grinder, whatever you want to call him, he's certainly not the only one. And
I
hope that one day you can go to an event with him and see him with all these other same guys at these tables and how much like next leveling and edging they're going through to try and get just like just $5 in value, right? Like it is amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So
sometimes
anyway.
These trades take a long time too, Cameron. The biggest trade I ever did was a $1,500 back and forth trade. And it took probably like an hour and a half.
Just keep on piling cards on top of each other? Is that what's happening?
Pretty much. You just got the stacks. Like, all right, you want this? We'll add this up. We'll add this up. And you just keep digging through binders. And it's like just the mother load.
It's quite the education, Cameron. Speaking of educating, Cameron, see what I did there?
Yeah, we've seen that.
No, do it again one more time, please.
I need to draw a flowchart. Let's do our little closing segment called Cameron Becomes a Spike. All right. right, so let me lay down this segment for the listener. Here's what the deal is. Cameron is a new Magic the Gathering player. We're trying to get him adjusted to the tournament scene. So every week I send him an older card. Not necessarily an older card, but a
tournament-worthy card.
Yeah, tournament-level play in older formats, and have Cameron do a card evaluation outside of the context of the decks that it's in. And our first one, I thought, would be apropos because we were talking about From the Vaults 20. It is Jace the Mind Sculptor. So, Cameron, there is a lot to read. Why don't you get started on that?
Okay, yeah, we got Jace the Mind Sculptor. He is a Planeswalker, Jace. His mana cost is 2 blue-blue. Did I say it correct, Curtis? Yeah? No? Okay. So,
yes, you got it.
Yeah, okay. So, he has a 3 loyalty counter on him. +2, look at the top card of your target player's library. You may put that card on the bottom of the player's library. 0 loyalty counters?
Well,
yes.
Hang on here. So basically, that would be what Fate Seal did. Right,
okay.
Curtis?
Right, right. So all of these are parallel with the cards that existed before in Magic's history.
Okay.
So keep going, Cameron.
Okay, 0 loyalty counters. Draw 3 cards, then put 2 cards from your hand on top of your library in any order.
Essentially a brainstorm.
Yeah.
A brainstorm.
Lose 1 loyalty counter. Return target creature to its owner's hand.
Which would be unsummon.
Unsummon, okay. And then the -12 ultimate. Exile all cards from target player's library. Then that player shuffles his or her hand into his or her library.
That's the win the game button, in case you didn't. Right.
Yeah, so I don't think you ever really get to that -12.
I've seen it happen.
Sure it happens, but like, you know, in like the real tournament play, you're really using those other 3 loyalty segments, right?
All right. Yeah. So let's start with just the overall evaluation of the card. So Cameron, A means amazing. F means you would never main deck it in a deck. Where do you think you have put this particular card?
This is amazing, right? This is a great card. First and foremost, you can very quickly get this guy up to 5 loyalty counters, which pretty much makes him protected from those cheap red spells that could kill him very quickly,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's something right there that's really, I think, important to look at it for him. The 0 ability, yeah. The ability to draw those 3 cards and then put it back in. You're really just kind of, whatever is in your hand, you're really kind of amping it up to find that card that you need very, very quickly. And then you also then have control of the battlefield by removing that dangerous creature that is on the battlefield right now and just putting it back into the owner's hand. So, that's kind of my assessment.
What do you think Jace is worth?
I don't know.
Let's keep in mind, this card was printed 3 years ago.
3 years ago? $60? $50?
Keep going.
80? 90? 100?
It's $150.
It's $150 now.
$150?
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
wow. And this, this is a broken card, right? Like, it's not in legal tournament play, right?
It was banned when it was in Standard. It is banned in Modern. It is legal in Legacy.
Okay.
Cameron, how much do you think, on average, a foil Japanese of this card is?
What, probably 6 times the price? 5 times the price?
$2,000.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
So here's the powerful thing about this card. If he is left undealt with for 2 turns, he buries the opponent in card advantage.
Definitely.
Because what the context that you're not seeing is the brainstorm effect combined with an effect that can shuffle your deck. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you draw those 3 cards, put 2 back that are not doing anything, and then you shuffle it with some other card that causes it to shuffle, like a fetch land, you've essentially exchanged 2 bad cards in your hand for 3 cards off the top of your deck, which in an older format is really good because all the cards in your deck are very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The Fade Seal ability does close out games. Like, you can ultimate and kill them. What'll happen with control decks is they control the board, they wipe the board, whatever. Then they start Fade Sealing their opponent. And Cameron, I want to tell you the most feel-bad moment in Magic. You have no cards in hand. Nothing but lands on the board. And the guy goes, okay, plus two Jace. Okay, you can keep it.
Right, which means it's probably another land.
It is the most character deflating thing that could ever happen to you.
Oh,
right? But, so, you know, it's one of those cards that it's weird. It wasn't really that great in the limited set it was in.
Right.
In Zendikar World, it was good, but it wasn't great. And in Standard, it was busted, and they haven't ever let it into Modern. It was banned before Modern started.
Right.
You know, it's really interesting to me. I mean, they have to have, whoever the designers of cards are, they have to have, these giant supercomputers that are analyzing every single possibility. And to, look at this card and say, yeah, we're going to print this and roll with it and see what happens. It's really interesting to me that they allowed that. Just because it is so obvious with this card that it's powerful.
It's the only Planeswalker
very
with,
powerful.
Yeah, it's the only Planeswalker with four abilities. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that because there's Garrick Relentless that can flip, right, Dustin? And he has, technically six or whatever.
He's winning.
The other thing is, man, Jace is the brand image, right? If you see a Magic the Gathering thing, Jace is the thing that ties with it.
You get that sweet mat, and he's always on the sweet mat, you know?
Right.
So I think it was also a branding decision, right? So anyway, Dustin, how do you think Cameron did with this card?
I think he did pretty good.
B minus.
it's a very powerful card. It's a very tradable card. It's a very good investment card. There's really no downside to Jace the Mind Sculptor.
Except for when you get Fate Sealed.
Right.
That's the only bad side. Anyway, let's close out the show for tonight. Gentlemen, do you have any closing thoughts?
No, we don't.
All right. For Dustin, Cameron, I am Curtis. You can catch up with me on Twitter at Curtis Now. Cameron, you are?
Cameron_McCoy.
And we are the Spike Feed. We will see you guys next week.